Today on Doomed! Trick or treat, everyone. It's a special, spooky Halloween edition of Doomed. We're talking scary stories, urban legends, fake news, and how they all spread on this edition of the show. I believe even Slenderman will be making an appearance, so let's dive right in. Let me pull up our guest on today's show, right here on the YouTube feed. Here we go. Boom. Boom. Ah, this is always fun when we're dealing with YouTube. Here we go. Joining me today is Dr. Lynn McNeil. She is a folklorist at Utah State University, author of Folklore Rules, and also co-author of Slenderman is Coming, Creepypasta and Contemporary Legends on the Internet. Lynn, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I love being here.
I really appreciate you coming on the show, especially being that it's Halloween Eve.
It is indeed.
And this is really the perfect time to talk about this type of stuff.
Yes.
This show, usually, you know, we talk about, I don't know, we run the gamut here on this show, but the show sort of has a focus on, you know, internet conspiracies, especially in like the political realm and fake news. But recently, actually, you and me spoke just earlier, late last week, I believe it was, because I'm writing an article for Mashable on an urban legend known as the Momo Challenge. And really, when I was speaking with you, we were talking, and the second, you know, we brought up certain stuff, I was like, I need to get you on this show. So it really worked out perfectly.
I'm so glad.
So let's get right into this.
All right.
Basically, let's start here, I guess, because I guess it would be good for the audience to sort of have a baseline here. What are urban legends?
Excellent question. So urban legends are stories that everyone's heard, that everyone tells, that everyone insists are definitely or at least really probably true, but that usually aren't. So when a folklorist uses this term, we actually kind of prefer the academic term contemporary legend, because urban legend is a bit of a misnomer. It initially really took off because it distinguished these stories from what we might call folk tales. Folk tales sound rural, rustic, old. Urban legends sound gritty and new and dark and, you know, contemporary. And that's really what they are, is contemporary. These are stories that comment on contemporary life. They happen in the suburbs. They happen in rural places. Urban, maybe not the best word, but folklorists are also pragmatists, and we know that that is what almost everyone calls them. So that is what we call them as well, urban legends. So we're looking at stories whose impact resides in the possibility that they might be true. That's really the defining characteristic, is this plausibility, these authenticating factors that make them seem really true, and also these sort of bizarre or strange elements that make you go, wait, really? What? That's possible? And that's why legends are, well, like my favorite genre of folklore, is because they're the genre we use to discuss possibilities.
Right, right. So let's actually break down the difference here, because, you know, you brought up folklore. So what differentiates folklore from urban legend?
Awesome. So folklore is really just a larger category of cultural expression. So if we can think of it hierarchically, that folklore is like an umbrella concept, and underneath folklore, we have a lot of different forms of cultural expression. So we have stories and jokes and speech, slang terms, you know, things we say. We have things we do, like holiday customs and gestures and handshakes and how we dress. And we have things we believe, like conceptual abstractions and folk religion and things like that. And so if folklore is all of those things, urban legends really fall kind of specifically into that stories subcategory of folklore. And of course, we have tons of different kinds of stories. We have fairy tales, we have myths, we have tall tales, we have legends, we have all different kinds of legends, and we have contemporary or urban legends that are a specific narrative form of folklore that deals in the question of the possibilities of reality.
Right.
I think that's the most succinct way I can put that.
I think that's quite succinct.
Good. Thank you. Folklorists are not known for a straightforward.
Oh, you froze there.
So I
Just go back a little bit. Folklorists are not known. No, don't worry about it. We just broke up.
Folklorists are not known for brief definitions of simple words. Folklorists love to take everyday common words that people do not have any problems with and problematize them. So I'm always happy when I can settle on a definition that, you know, takes less than an hour.
Well, you know, it sort of makes, I guess that makes sense for the, for especially the subgenre of folklore known as urban legends, because it seems like urban legends are all over the place in terms of, you know, what an urban legend is. Like you just described, you know, again, a basic summarization, a straightforward way to describe urban legends. But, you know, when you think of different types of urban legends, they really are just, best way to describe it, I guess, is just all over the place.
Absolutely all over the place. And sometimes they come to us as kind of full drawn out stories. And sometimes they come to us just as really brief references, you know, things where we can't even really say someone just told a story in this moment, but we know that they're referencing like this whole complex of different legendary ideas. Like one of the most common topics for urban legends is personal safety and crime. That's clearly a thing that we really stress out about in contemporary society. And so, of course, we tell tons of stories through which we can ask each other, do you think this is really possible? Could this really happen to me? Is this something I should be worried about? Is this the direction the world is going in right now? What do I need to think about this? And we tell each other these stories. One of my favorite examples, it's actually not that popular anymore as an urban legend, which makes me sad, is the old kidney heist, waking up in a bathtub full of ice.
Right.
You're familiar with that story. So that's, I mean, that one's so well known as an urban legend that barely anyone believes it anymore, but it still speaks to things. I mean, the setting of that legend is always a person on a business trip. They get offered a drink by some stranger. Next thing they know, bathtub full of ice, note taped to the phone. And it's interesting because very few people tell that story now anymore. It's more just like a referent. Or like a kernel that we can go to. So, you know, your friend's headed out for a business trip and you're like, okay, you know, don't wake up in a bathtub full of ice, you know, watch your drinks. Like it's this shorthand way of referencing all of those fears that that legend speaks to. So when a legend becomes so familiar that we stop telling it, we still find ways to tell it.
Right. I wonder how much of that particular legend sort of, not, I don't want to say dying out, but not being so easily believed as an actual tale has to do with like, I feel like movies really took that legend and like, made it, you know, visual in the movie. So when you hear it now, you think, oh, that's that scene from this movie instead of, oh, I heard that actually happened to some guy in this faraway place or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Books and movies can crush an urban legend so fast. One, by just highlighting its fictionality, kind of by going like, you know, none of us see a movie like Urban Legend or like, oh, that's ripped from the headlines. Like, no, what's, oh, okay, these stories are fake.
Right.
But the thing about urban legends, thing about all folklore in general, is that by definition, it evolves. It keeps up with us. The minute something isn't believable to us or isn't relevant to us, we drop it. We stop saying it. We stop talking about it. They might still make movies about it, but folk culture is dynamic, variable, and fast. And so the minute something isn't relevant, we move on and we start telling stories and rumors about the stuff that is.
Right. So talking about how, you know, urban legend moving fast, how do urban legends typically spread?
Yeah. So urban legends really rely on person-to-person communication. That's really what injects that dynamism and that variability. So we're not looking at something like a news broadcast or a video reproduction, which is always the same every time new people encounter it. We're looking at something that's recreatable, something that operates more as a meme than a viral video, where each new person gets to put their stamp on it, reshape it, recreate it. And that can happen offline, and that can happen online. When it's online, it happens a lot faster. And we see a merging of that word of mouth, person to person transmission that folklore follows. I call it the big game of telephone that is the folklore transmission process. We see that becoming merged with this ability, as you're doing right now, to broadcast ourselves, everyday people having this broadcast ability power that we didn't have before. So now, you know, it's still me, I'm free form talking, but I'm talking to a bigger audience than I could if I were not online, if I were not using technology right now. So it's sort of the transmission process of urban legends when we come into these digital spaces sort of looks like a big game of telephone, and then all of a sudden this burst of mass broadcast, and then all the little people that that reaches go into their own game of telephone where they tell friends about it over coffee or breakfast, and then maybe also post it to social media and hit that big broadcast blast that we're able to do now even with our folk culture. So it's an amazing, messy, networked transmission process that just takes over so quickly, so that the minute something's occurred, 2 days later, you're already thinking, yeah, everyone's talking about that right now. Isn't that funny? And the reality is, even when it happened offline, it was still pretty fast. It's just way faster now.
Right, right. So, you know, I'm just thinking about some of the, you know, the particular urban legends that I've heard, you know, over the years, and especially, you know, I consider, you know, the one that always comes to mind as a pre-internet urban legend is, you know, the woman's driving alone, pulls up to a gas station attendant tries to tell her something, but she drives off because she's spooked by him, and it turns out there's like a axe murderer in the back seat of her car.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. That's led to a lifetime of me checking my back seat
right.
to make sure there's not an axe murderer there when I get in it.
Right. And I feel like, you know, I mean, I even check it. I don't even think I'm the target audience, because I feel like that's the, you know, that's one that's like, you know, women shouldn't drive alone. Yep. You know, that's really, you know, so,
yeah.
So, you know, it's sort of like, to me, you know, when I think of these pre-internet urban legends, it's like, you know, they spread in a way where I feel like it's just so focused on sort of I don't know if it's exactly a life lesson, not one that maybe you yourself want to share, but I feel like something that, you know, your parents when you were a kid would want you to believe, just so they wouldn't have to, you know, it would be easier for them to tell you that. Yeah.
Yeah. A cautionary tale.
Exactly.
In a lot of ways. Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting, no folklore, but urban legends, especially, they never circulate for no reason. There's never a story that's sticky in the right way that isn't saying something to us or about us or both. I mean, folklore is one of the main ways that we talk about ourselves to ourselves in our small groups, in our discourse communities, in what we as folklorists would call folk groups or subcultures. I mean, this is the stuff that we use to symbolically communicate about our lived experiences. You know, we could sit down and have pragmatic conversations about crime and dangers and things like that. Or we can tell each other really good, sticky stories that we hear that dramatize and illustrate all of those same fears, and let that conversation play out in sort of that slightly removed way where we're maybe less worried that people are just trying to reassure us. We can kind of make it about these abstract other people that this story happened to, and is that really possible? And what's interesting is that the faster stories go, the more on the fly the symbolism has to be. So like the old offline legends you're talking about, the killer in the back seat, that's like some heavy-handed symbolism there, right? It's always a young woman. She's always driving alone at night, and she sort of is in this catch-22 position where there's a creepy dude at a gas station menacing her because there's a creepy dude in the backseat menacing her. It's like she's got creepy dudes on all sides.
Right.
Legends often present to us sort of these lose-lose situations of personal safety where it's like, yeah, okay, you know, the moral of this story is trust one of the creepy dudes because he's protecting you from other creepy dudes. And, you know, when you're a woman sharing these stories, it's just sort of like, yeah, right? I mean, what are you going to do? How are we going to get out of this one? And so it's interesting, the message of sometimes futility that we get from urban legends or real antisocial messages. There's a lot of popular urban legends that circulate about ways that bad guys will lure you off the highway when you're driving. So one of the most popular ones is that someone will put a baby car seat with a lifelike looking doll of an infant in it, like on the side of the road or in a ditch. So it looks like somehow this car seat fell off of the trunk of a car or somehow, you know, ended up on the side of the road to lure, you know, a sympathetic person, usually a woman, to pull over, get out, inspect it. And that's when they either steal your car, kidnap you, rape you, any of these terrible things. And that's not to downplay the terribleness of those crimes that are actually committed, but to say that none of this has ever actually happened. And it's always an abstract. It's never, here's the news story where that actually did happen, and the end result of it, the result big, but very, very dire.
Right. And, you know, when, you know, just thinking of you know, and being that Halloween's tomorrow, the urban legend of you know, there's, you know, check your candy because there might be some sort of, you know, you might bite into that Kit Kat bar and there's a needle inside or something, or you'll take a eat that sweet tart and it turns out to be some sort of drug that you shouldn't be taking or something. I don't know. Just crazy stories like that, particularly about Halloween as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually, there's a folklorist named Jack Santino who's written a lot about Halloween candy scares, Halloween folklore in general. And, you know, the research that he's done, it's actually almost a sadder reality, has shown that there have only been a true handful. I mean, we're talking two or three actual cases of candy tampering. And in all the documented cases, it was parents attempting to harm their own children. So it's not this widespread conspiracy of razor blades and apples and rat poison and Snickers bars. It's parents using a legend. And that's a process that folklorists call ostension. Ostension is the acting out of a legend, or the acting in response to a legend. So we see this ostensive behavior being used by parents who, for whatever reason, are attempting to harm their own children and using this shared narrative as a way to cover it up, or make it seem believable that, well, everyone knows candy's tainted, so no one will suspect me. And it's like, yeah, everyone does know that candy's tainted, even though candy has pretty much never been tainted.
Right. It sounds like the problem isn't the Halloween candy. The problem is, you know, mommy or daddy have like Munchausen by proxy or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's really a strange thing. And, you know, we see a lot of contemporary fears reflected in Halloween legends. The most popular one now is that people are going to be giving out edibles, as in cannabis edibles or ecstasy that looks like candy, when, you know, we have now sort of a backlash narrative forming where people are starting to, you know, come out and say, or even better, make memes that say, you know, no one's going to give away thousands of dollars of drugs to strangers.
Right.
Like that just doesn't make sense.
Right. I feel like urban legends, like the, you know, the something, you know, the some sort of thing that will harm the child in the candy, you know, that's something that scares both the parents and the kids. I feel like, you know, you tell kids that there's an urban legend, well, they don't know it's an urban legend, but you tell kids the new urban legend that there might be an edible brownie in their Halloween basket, and they're going to be like, point me in the direction of that house.
Yeah, like, wait, how did I get there? Yeah, it is. It's weird. And it's you bring up a really good point, too, that these stories don't come to us labeled as urban legends. The minute someone says, hey, have you heard the latest urban legend? We're immediately like, oh, the latest fake story. I mean, that's right. Our association. There are some true urban legends. There are some legitimately true urban legends. All urban legends, even if they are factually untrue, contain some true element, whether it's what they're saying about society, the commentary they're making, what it is about our shared ideology and values that they're reflecting. So there's a truth there, but they don't come to us labeled in a way that signals literal falsehood. So it's an interesting thing to think about. It's a genre that, you know, by the time it's labeled urban legend, it's probably not in active circulation anymore. The urban legends, the things we would classify as urban or contemporary legends right now, are things that we are hearing about under the category of a thing that happened. You know, it's your friends or your coworkers or your family sitting down with you and being like, oh my gosh, did you guys hear what happened today? And that's it. That's the opening formula. That's the urban legends once upon a time. And it's so rooted in reality. Did you hear what happened today? Did you hear what this journalist dug up? Did you hear what this president said? Did you hear what happened, you know, on Facebook? And it has this air of validity that makes it really hard to scoff at, the way we're sort of inclined when we hear urban legends as urban legends. We sort of go, who would ever believe that? But when you hear it
Right.
from a person you trust telling you, hey, this is a thing that happened, we pretty much are guaranteed to not think super critically. And if then the information that follows that matches up with our worldview, we're pretty much guaranteed not to think about that critically because we're like, yeah, that sounds like something that would happen. And it just goes into the back of our minds and sort of builds into this reinforcement of expectation. And this is, of course, where the idea of echo chambers becomes really dangerous. You know, that if you're only hearing the folkloric content from like-minded people, it builds up this bigger and bigger and bigger backstory of assumptions about what's happening or about how the world works that make it unbelievably hard to penetrate with single debunking facts. This is one of the most tricky things about urban legends, is that by the time this whole social process has been taking place for a while, it is really hard to counteract.
Right. And you know, this sounds a lot like how fake news spreads.
Yes, absolutely. This is why folklorists have jumped on the fake news bandwagon, is we pretty much all looked at that and we're like, hey, that's our content. Like, that's our stuff.
Right.
Fake
You're
news makes
experts in
people
it
like
already.
us. Yeah, it
Right.
was actually really exciting to discover that. The 2017 annual meeting of the American Folklore Society, there were four separately proposed panels on fake news. And each of those panels had like 4 to 7 participants. So there were almost 30 folklorists just that year who were just like, I need to be writing about this. And now we have a special issue of the Journal of American Folklore entirely about fake news, which just came out this fall, which is cool.
That sounds like something I gotta pick up, because that sounds extremely interesting for my beat here.
Yeah, no,
And
it's really, I'll try and send you a copy.
oh, that'd be perfect. So the way, so you know, urban legends and fake news, they seem to spread in similar ways. You were discussing, you know, how urban legends spread, you know, offline, when you're sitting at the table with family and people are just saying things they heard from friends or friends of a friend or coworkers. And then, you know, the same thing sort of happens online with fake news. And it seems like, you know, depending on, you know, where you see it, who's sharing it, what exactly is being said, does it sound believable enough for you not to, you know, have to dig in any further? And, you know, oh, that sounds true. Why look into it anymore? I'll believe it. You know, it seems like these sort of things overlap. The same things that you know, the same reason people believed in the axe murderer in the back seat or the tainted Halloween candy is the same reason they're believing that, I don't know, Donald Trump single-handedly rescued 100 kittens from the latest hurricane in Florida or something like that.
Yes, absolutely. And it is, and it's these validations of our worldview is really what it starts to come down to. Fake news is interesting because there are a bunch of different potential points of origin for it. It can begin as urban legends begin with rumor that's untraceable, that where we can't boil it down to something. It can begin in misinformed actual news broadcasts that later get retracted, but too late, that earlier version's already out there circulating. It can begin as satire. The Onion, The Daily Show have done an amazing job in many ways of perpetuating stuff that looks like news but isn't. And
Right.
when they really nail the tone, the style, that parody, that satire, when they get that just right, you strip the onion off the top of that fake newspaper page, you plaster any other newspaper thing on it, and it sure looks believable. So the affordances of technology are really coming into that as well. And then, of course, we have just straight up maliciously created, paid for efforts at generating fake news for the sake of being divisive. So we have all these different points of origin, from innocuous to intentionally malicious, from misinformed to satire or parody. By the time those stories enter into that folkloric transmission process where they're being shared person to person, they're urban legends. That they function in indistinguishable ways from urban legends. So that question of origin is so easily obscured that, again, they come to us in this way as a friend's social media post, as breakfast conversation with your family members, maybe even pitched convincingly visually as an actual news report. And we speak about them, we react to them. We often don't read full news articles wherein the satire or the hoax might reveal itself. We stick with headlines. There was a great article that circulated about how people don't read articles, and the headline was something about an asteroid coming to hit Earth, like in the coming year or something.
Right.
And I mean, I'm a folklorist. A huge number of people I own are folklorists, and this came through my news feed. Not even seriously, but sort of with a, like a, well, guys, yes, we better start getting ready for the end of the... And then click on it, there's like one short fake paragraph about the asteroid, and then it's like, okay, so this article is really about how nobody's reading this article.
Right.
And it's just that, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I often notice, you know, on Facebook, you know, a friend from high school who I haven't spoken to in forever, who I really should remove from Facebook by now, but for some reason I don't. You know, they'll post something with a really, you know, provocative headline, something that may sound real enough. You know, the headline will have maybe the name of a politician, some sort of policy proposal that's been in the news, but then some sort of outlandish happening, you know, that politician supports this crazy policy that's been in the news or doesn't support this crazy policy that's been in the news. And you look and it sounds just believable enough, but then you see the URL and it's like realnews125@.blogspot.com. And it's like, come on, man, just look at the URL.
Yep. I know, right? This is what's interesting though. So the article that I contributed to this special issue of the Journal of American Folklore about fake news was looking at this very question of what's the source? Like, what's the source that adds the validity? And this grew, this research interest for me grew out of a thing that happened to me, which was that after the 2016 election, after fake news became this really big thing and that people were sort of talking about, someone posted to social media a list of untrustworthy websites. And it looked legit. It was like a Google Doc. It had the name of a professor who I didn't know or anything like that on it. But I'm like, oh, this is really useful. So I shared it. And then, as how social media works, a friend of mine shared it. And then a mutual friend commented on that person's sharing of it and said, hey, how do you know this is valid? Like, where did this come from? And that friend who'd shared it said, well, Lynn McNeil posted it, and that's good enough for me. And I was right. Like, oh, no.
Right.
Oh, no, that shouldn't be good enough. This is terrible. Because I didn't fact check it. I mean, I didn't even look to see if the person that supposedly authored it was a real person, really at that university or anything. It just had all the visual markers of believability. And so I believed it. And I didn't post it and say, this is 100% verifiably true and you can all trust it. I posted it and said something, I'm sure, hedgy, like, oh, this looks interesting, guys. Check it out for yourselves. But my posting of it was all the validation it needed for my friends. And that was eye-opening for me to see that it's less the author. It's less the URL. It's even less what shows up when you follow the link. I have an example of a tweet that someone tweeted a link to a news article that links to some shady website. And when you get there, it's a Photoshop screen of a Fox News broadcast. That's not true at all.
Right. That happens a lot, I feel like. I always see these sort of Photoshopped newscasts.
Absolutely.
The chyron just changed. It's clearly not the usual Fox or CNN font. It's just so obviously Photoshop,
exactly.
But people, just the visual itself is enough for people just to be like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, and if you hold opinions about Fox News, either that it is inherently untrustworthy or that it is inherently trustworthy, that's going to lean you in a certain direction. So we have the potential authority of Fox News. We have the potential authority or non-authority of the website. But then we have the potential authority of the person who tweeted it or posted it. And that's really where a lot of our assumption of validity lies. And this is interesting because when a story moves into that folkloric transmission process, it becomes talk. And talk is a whole different mode of information gathering than research. And we tend to think of this as like a critical thinking issue, a good research issue. You know, you need to do your research and, you know, cite your sources and find this information. And yeah, absolutely. If you're writing a paper for school, you should. But we don't fact check talk. We don't research talk. We don't reverse Google image search talk. And
right.
Social media is talk in a lot of ways, even though it masquerades as news, as information, as research. It's conversation, and we treat it like conversation. And so the person speaking does a lot of the heavy lifting for how we feel about something. And when that person speaking, I mean, if it's your crazy Uncle Rich who you're like, I've never agreed with the thing Uncle Rich has ever said in his life, that context shift completely alters how you will read the headline that Uncle Rich posts. But if it's someone with whom you know you share a worldview, you share a lot of the same values and beliefs and ideologies, I'm not going to question it. They might as well have just pulled up next to me, sat down at the coffee shop and said, did you hear what happened today? Except that it happened digitally on my social media feed, but it has that same validation. So it's interesting. We're all getting pretty good at calling out the other side, the people we disagree with on fake news. It's really ourselves. I mean, this is a very humbling experience doing this research, is realizing the level to which I need to check my own worldview, assumptions, cultural expectations before I allow that information to just sort of become background noise. But I think there's also something reassuring in the idea that this isn't totally new. There's actually folklorists, legend scholars, who wrote about the idea of the echo chamber in the mid-1970s, who were already saying, when we put rumor and legend out into the world, we often get it back in this feedback loop where we do not realize how small our folk groups, our discourse communities really are, so that we're just hearing back what we put out. And they actually used the word echo to talk about this. And then, you know, 2016, we find ourselves in these, you know, Facebook rabbit holes where we don't hear from anyone we don't disagree with. And then we're all shocked at how the world goes. So it's folklore studies has been a strangely prescient discipline in recent years.
No, it certainly is. I mean, you have, you know, conspiracies like QAnon out there and, you know, Pizzagate, which is thankfully, I think people have dropped by now, but it sort of got rolled into QAnon, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're at the, I'm a member of the International Society for Contemporary Legend Research, real thing, with a real journal. Contemporary Legend is the name of the journal. And at the meeting, I think 2 years ago, there were several presentations on Pizzagate. I mean, that was, you know, folklorists are also the folk. We're also there, you know, trying to figure out what the heck is happening in the world. And Pizzagate's a great example of something that shows the power of folklore. These are not mere stories. These are things that lead to action, that lead to dangerous action, and that need people to pay attention to them. You know, we talk a lot in folklore studies about the triviality barrier, that folklore is all that cultural stuff that's so trivial that no one thinks we should pay attention to it. Like, we're the discipline that studies jump rope rhymes and internet memes. Like, you know, people are just sort of like, hey, aren't academics supposed to study like the great canon of literature and physics? And it's like, well, yeah, we are. But by the time that something is so trivial that people treat it as a given, we should be working to understand what those givens are, dramatizing, symbolizing, articulating, so that we can know what's informing everyday people's decisions and actions.
Right, right. And, you know, especially in, you know, in since I would say, you know, 2015, 2016, with the certain different groups that have risen from certain, you know, elections and political, you know, climate changes, I guess. You know, the fringes who would spread these conspiracies have now become the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we you know, we hear the phrase, we've been described as a post-truth society. This amplification that the internet provides of voices is a blessing and a curse. You know, early scholars of the internet would say things like, where will this take us? Will this be a utopian future where, you know, every underdog has a platform for his or her voice to be heard? Or will this become a tool of, you know, tyranny where people will control what we're able to hear and, you know, manipulate all of us? And it's just sort of like, yeah, okay, you know, both. Like, right. This is, we are witnessing post-modernity taking place. There are multiple truths and multiple realities, and yet we're left with ballots in our hands having to vote for something. And the more we are attempting to understand sort of that polyvalent nature of culture, the better informed we're going to be.
Right.
I think.
No, I completely agree. And, you know, we just have a few more minutes until you have to jump. So, and it's, and like I mentioned earlier, it's Halloween Eve. So really quickly, I wanted to talk about Slender Man.
Awesome. So, yes,
so,
I love it.
So first off, I think to understand Slenderman, you have to know his origin story. Mm-hmm. Who created him, and then sort of what took, you know, I know Creepypasta came in after and sort of fleshed out Slenderman's origin story even more. So let's even jump before that. Who created Slenderman? Where did he come from?
Yeah, so Slenderman arrived on the scene, surprisingly true to his current form. He is kind of surprisingly consistent. 2009, on the Something Awful forums, there was a thread that was about creating paranormal images, and a user named Victor Surge, his real name is Eric Knudsen, posted two photographs, both, he didn't even use the name Slender Man, just two photographs, both of which depicted children. One was kids playing in a playground and looking at the camera, and sort of in the background, in the shadows under a tree, is this tall figure, kind of a blank face, wearing a dark suit, almost this suggestion of tendrils, tentacles maybe, coming off his body. And in the upper right-hand corner of the picture is this seal that says the Sterling City Library. And then the other picture was of children looking sort of visibly upset, walking down what looks like a dirt road, sort of being led by a figure that looks like the same figure in this other picture, tall, black suit, blank face. No tendrils or tentacles in this picture, but it's a little bit clearer than the other one. Both of the pictures were accompanied with captions, and the captions, in my professional opinion, are kind of the superstars. I mean, they're beautifully photoshopped images as well, but the captions are really where we get that perfect blend of really specific details like names and dates and places that just speak to an authenticating veracity. And also these huge plot holes that, if this were an artistic endeavor, would surely have been filled in. So that combination of specific details and huge gaping holes in logic actually mimics reality in the ideal way for a legend, just perfectly. So this was it. That was it. That was the birth of Slender Man. And these two photos just resonated with people. I mean, it was like wildfire from there, that we got Marble Hornets, the YouTube series, we got old Romanian folktales and ancient German woodcuts, and just a plethora of additional photographs and video footage and all of these sort of added tropes to the mythos, where we start seeing that, you know, Slender Man is interested specifically in children. He becomes almost this Pied Piper character. He creates electrical distortion when he's nearby. So if you're filming, that's a way that you know that something is happening. And we see that in the video games. We see that in Marble Hornets. And it's just, it's like this perfect, perfect storm of legend components got put together into this creature that symbolically speaks to us on so many different levels. I mean, one of my favorite interpretations of Slender Man is that he sort of represents a combo of like consumer culture and surveillance culture. Like, he is the embodiment of that feeling where you're sitting at home talking about how you need purple shoes for the upcoming weekend, and then you log onto Facebook and it's all ads for purple shoes, and you're like, what, did my phone hear me? Like, what's going on? Like he's dressed sort of corporate. He would almost look genteel and trustworthy, except he's got like these tentacles that are reaching out for you, and it's distressing, and he's appealing. He's luring children in. Like, oh man, I mean, we were just waiting on this symbol to show up. And then of course, in 2014, which is when most people heard of Slender Man, was because two young girls in Wisconsin stabbed a third young girl 19 times in the woods in order to become proxies of Slender Man. And Slender Man was immediately a household name in a lot of ways, and in a very negative way. It was just automatically, why would anyone create this horrible monster that asks girls to stab their friend? And of course, he didn't specifically ask anyone to do such a thing. So it was a rough time for Slender Man. And he's, in that beautiful way of folklore, he's moved on already. There's sort of a new growing mythos, especially among young kids. Slender Man is becoming an ally in the fight against bullying. He's sort of a family man now. He's got a daughter, Slendrina. He's got a mother-in-law. He's got a wife. Like, it's fascinating. I mean, there is so much still to research about Slender Man. Thankfully, I will remain employed, I hope.
Right. So it seems like, you know, Slender Man is just the perfect embodiment of sort of, I guess, you know, how these legends not only spread, I guess, on the internet, but grow in terms of like new backstories. It's almost like,
you know,
Slender Man is his own like fictional, I guess, Star Wars canon type, like he's in his own world.
Yeah, absolutely. His mythos. That's the term that gets used when something grows this big and this powerfully. People begin emically, meaning the content creators themselves begin using this term mythos. We see that also with like Cthulhu, the Cthulhu mythos based on the works of H.P. Lovecraft, where we can sort of go, yeah, Cthulhu was wholesale a fictional invention of Lovecraft, but people are so intrigued by that whole idea that they start filling in backstory and creating references to these different things that Lovecraft talked about until we have sort of this crowdsourced mythos. And that's what we have with Slender Man and that's really the value of folklore, is because it's culture that average everyday people can take in and adapt and adjust and evolve and make meaningful for themselves in their context, and then send it back out on its way for someone else to take and adapt and evolve and make meaningful and send it back out. We have sort of this communal process of shaping that leaves us with something really reflective of a group's ideologies and values and beliefs and concerns. And so we use folklore, folklorists do, as a barometer for that. You know, what folklore is really sticking right now? And what does that folklore tell us about the people who are sharing it? That's the job of a folklorist. And it's awesome.
Right.
I think it's awesome.
I think so too. You know, as we're talking about urban legends and fake news and the context of all these things, I just realized that, you know, today actually is the anniversary of that infamous War of the Worlds broadcast.
Yes, that is. And I mean, War of the Worlds is an awesome early version of that blurring of reality and fiction that creepypasta, when done well, just super excels at. And we have other. We have some other examples. The Blair Witch Project really stumped a lot of people when it first came out. That was, you know, the kicking off the found footage film genre, which folklorists have studied as well as sort of the cinematic version of legends, a form of film that tries to seem plausible, believable. You know, the gaps and the holes are a part of the authenticating of that material. Of course, no one's recording all the time. So, right. You know, you get those blank spaces that scream, this could be real. So, War of the Worlds is an awesome example of something coming so true to form that you didn't really know. I mean, the other one that comes up a lot, and actually there's a chapter that talks about this in the Slender Man book, was the Discovery Channel's Mermaids program, where they really just sort of like doubled down on, we're going to pitch this as though it's real. And it was, I don't know, I'm still sort of unclear on whether it was parody or like a mockumentary or satire or a hoax or what, but people were just like, wait, this seems real. This is, you know, on television.
You add that it's on Discovery too, where people,
they think. We have that authenticating factor that we're like, well, they wouldn't lie to us, right?
Right.
So yeah, it's really, it is. There's precedent for all of this stuff. And that's what's so cool is that, you know, we can see incredible changes wrought by digital communications technology, but we go back to the radio and we have people engaging in play and parody, satire, hoaxes, all of that stuff in really similar ways. And people kind of ambivalently reacting to it going, hey, wait, what do I do with this? What do I make of this? How do I talk about this with my friends and family and perpetuating it and, you know, spreading it out into the world.
Right. So Dr. Lynn McNeil, folklorist at Utah State University, author of Folklore Rules, and co-author of Slender Man is Coming, Creepypasta, and Contemporary Legends on the Internet. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. It was fantastic to talk to you. Hopefully,
awesome.
Hopefully, no one sort of, I guess, tuned in halfway through and suddenly missed the context and believes that mermaids are real. Slender Man is after them. And and all that fun stuff. Yeah. All right. Take care. Happy Halloween.
Cool. Thank you very much. Happy Halloween to you and all of your viewers and listeners.
Have a good night.
Thanks. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Hope you all enjoyed the special Halloween broadcast of Doomed with Matt Binder. I know a few of you. I can see right now that the YouTube viewership isn't where it usually is, because I know a few of you were a little bit upset that I was running up against some of your other favorite shows that happened to broadcast on Tuesday nights, and only on Tuesday nights. Whereas I usually, you could usually catch me on a Monday or a Wednesday or a Thursday. But, you know, it's the night before Halloween. The interview with Lynn was presented to me, and it was just too perfect to turn down, to not line that all up perfectly. And you could all listen to the podcast if you're missing this live. You snooze, you lose, but you know what? Here at Undoomed, you might miss the live stream, but we'll wake you up for the rebroadcast in podcast form. You like that one? I just don't know that off the top of my head. Wasn't that good, so you probably knew that I just thought about it off the top of my head. Oh, well. To support this show, patreon.com/MattBinder is where you go. And when you're there, you can become a patron. And when you become a patron, you give the show a little bit of money. And when you give the show a little bit of money, you get to help the show reach its goals. And when the show reaches its goals, I give you more content. Pretty cool, right? In fact, this week is already a sneak peek of what this additional content will look like. Because I got news for you guys. This being a Tuesday, this being the special Halloween edition of Doomed, means there's another episode coming at you this week too. I will let you guys all know a little bit more online. Why am I teasing it? On Thursday at 9:30 p.m., there will be another episode of Doomed. Rarely do I get to announce to you what's going on a week in advance, because usually after this episode goes up as the podcast, I get right to booking the next one. But this one's already booked. We'll be talking to David Bixenspan for, you guessed it, a very special pro wrestling episode. And I know a lot of you like the pro wrestling episodes, and I know a lot of you are saying to yourself, what's going on, another wrestling episode? Listen, the last wrestling episode on the show was WrestleMania back in March. Doomed is primed. This is prime time now for Doomed to have another pro wrestling episode. So I'll be talking to David Bixenspan, and this one, even if you're not a wrestling fan, might interest you, because we'll be talking about the WWE's decision to go forward with their Saudi Arabia event the very next day, on Friday, amid all the sorts of really pressure, public pressure, political pressure, over Saudi Arabia's straight-up murder of a journalist, excuse me. So that'll be a good episode. I will tell you guys more about that as the days go on, but it's happening Thursday night. David Bixenspan will join us. Sean Zone asks me on the YouTube channel, are you going to have Jared Holt on again soon? I will. He's already been on this show twice. There's been a few people who've been on this show twice. Interestingly enough, most of them have been people who cover the right. And by interestingly enough, I'm being sarcastic, because that's what this show usually really excels at covering. The people who've been on this show twice, Jared Holt, Kelly Weil, Will Sommer, Michael Brooks. So whichever one of those I book next will be the first Doomed guest to be on this show thrice. That'll be a fun little accolade for whoever that person may be. That should go right up with their title when they pitch themselves to other shows and programs. Let's go to... Oh, wait, let me continue promoting the show. See, I'm not that good of a self-promo. You guys know that. subscribe to the show on iTunes, leave a review. Just go to iTunes, search Doomed, and the show will come up. Leave a 5-star review. Well, you don't have to leave a 5-star review, but I implore you to leave a 5-star review. But definitely leave a written review with whatever star review you leave. I really appreciate the written reviews. Apple really appreciates the written reviews because they look at the written reviews and the star reviews as ways to their algorithm sort of looks at how they promote certain shows on the iTunes store. You can also support this show, health, by subscribing to this very YouTube channel, Doomed.tv. That's the easiest way to get to this YouTube channel, Doomed.tv. Renee is going boo. Why is Renee booing me? Renee left the first comment in this episode's live stream with the very prescient Slender Binder comment. Thank you. I am quite slender. Not lanky, though. I'm not quite Slender Man, and, you know, he's tall and lanky. I'm sort of short. Not stout so much. I'm sort of slender. Not too skinny. I used to be sort of skinny, but I packed on some weight. Thankfully, actually. I could use the pounds. Ryan Kelly. Uncles cannot tell what is a shoop. Yeah. Sean Zone says, leave a review on iTunes. Sean Zone also says, I'm subscribed everywhere. Let's see. Are you subscribed everywhere? Let's go through it. Doom.tv takes you to the YouTube channel. Are you subscribed to the YouTube channel? There's the iTunes subscription, or if you have Google Play, one of those, whichever. I still got to get us on Stitcher. I'll get on top of that. If there's any other sort of podcast platform you guys use that isn't automatic, that doesn't automatically find this feed and take it, like Stitcher doesn't, let me know. I'm going to go after all those and set it up to make it really easy for you all to download and listen to this podcast. What else? You know to follow me at Matt Binder on Twitter. There is a Twitter that I just grabbed for this show, at Doomed Pod, that I really don't use. Maybe I should set it up so it's sort of automatically, you know, just let you guys know when shows are happening, when podcasts go up. Maybe I'll set that up if that would be helpful for you guys. But for Twitter, you know, to come to at Matt Binder for really the latest about this show. There's patreon.com/MattBinder where you will usually be the first to know about when a feed's going up. And, of course, there's the Discord channel. You guys should all be on there. Going to try to get things more active on there, but I'm trying to get things more active on this show as a whole. You know, it's there's a good number of people who download this podcast. Thousands of people download every episode of this podcast. I can see it. I can see it. But some platforms are more tricky than others. What else? I think that's really... I have a Facebook page, not for this podcast, but for... Along with my personal Facebook profile, there's also a person... I have a Facebook page. I'm going to try to start posting more on there. Maybe not even go by Matt Binder on the page, maybe go by Doomed or something. It seems like there is sort of a gap in my social media networking on Facebook. I need to get on there. I always hated Facebook, but you know what? I feel like it's really been, especially with the people who would share this type of stuff, I think. People who would be interested in fake news because they're seeing it all the time over on Facebook. Renee says, been dealing with a pseudo-anarchist troll who revealed himself to be a sexist and a classist hypocrite. So scary monsters and super creeps, boo as in ghost. Do I leave one of my long-winded podcast reviews? Says Renee. Yes, please, leave a long-winded podcast review. Leave a real good podcast review, like a full-on, I'm not asking you to write a piece that you would send somewhere and get paid to. You know, if you could write like a good paragraph selling this show. You know, I'm not going to force you to. I'm not going to say you're going to get anything out of it. Just if you like this show, leave one of those good reviews. It helps. Renee says, got to go shirtless on Twitch like Hassan Piker. Maybe I'll do that. Knowing what Hassan looks like, I don't know if that will help in subscriber count, it might actually, for me, have the reverse outcome than it does for Hassan. But I can try it if it's important. If you really think it's going to work, I'll do that, Renee. I will. You know, I had pitched to people earlier today. Not many. There's just a few people earlier today who were talking to me about doing the show today. And their worries about it going up against, I can say who, the Michael Brooks Show, I guess, which has become a staple on Tuesday nights now. I know to try to, usually try to not book a show for Tuesday nights, usually on a Monday or a Sunday or a Wednesday or a Thursday. But, like I said, this presented itself to me today, and it's Halloween Eve. I had to do it. You know, but I'd pitch to people, you know, really, this should be seen as the old WWE, WCW Monday Night Wars tonight. It should have felt reminiscent of that, but for progressive leftist podcasts and YouTube live streams. You should have had both the Doomed feed and the Michael Brooks Show feed going, and you should have been switching through back and forth between the tabs, toggling the volume controls, and catching one of us when a particular part was especially good. And I know that might have resulted in the Michael Brooks Show being muted for the entirety of its broadcast, but it would have been a fun little throwback to the Monday Night Wars days for you wrestling fans. But I guess more people didn't agree with me on that one. Oh, well. Renee says, Binder Damas. Misha and Kennedy should invite their friends. Sean Zone says, I was watching the Michael Brooks Show until I got the Doomed notification. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I guess the notifications went out late. This is how I look at it. Yeah. The Michael Brooks Show is every Tuesday night, which I will very soon, hopefully, once there's enough backing for the show that I could carve out a specific time and a specific night to do so. There will be a night where you know to catch Doomed. And I do know that's probably hurting the growth of the show a bit, not having a set night every week. But I just can't do that right now because of other obligations. You guys, we've been through this already. In fact, very upsetting for me. All month, my son, Ezra, has really been looking forward. He's 3 years old. The old Majority Report listeners know all about Ezra. I gotta say, working for the Majority Report when he was born was easily, one of the best places I could have been, because I have so many great, well wishes recorded for all eternity sent in to Sam live during the show, congratulating me and wishing Ezra well. So I really appreciated all you did that. But getting back to that. Ezra's been looking forward to Halloween all month. Literally, the second he saw the decorations go up, local home, apartments and houses, and he goes to, when he goes shopping, the stores, like the grocery store or Target, put up their Halloween stuff super early, like mid-September, I feel like, even early September, maybe. He was really excited for it. And then all of a sudden yesterday, he's playing, and then he just stops. Sits on the couch, lays down, and says he doesn't feel good. And, we feel him, and he's burning up. We're not exactly sure what he's got. We took him to, the doctor. They're not quite sure what it is, if it's, a 24-hour bug or a cold, a fever, or if it's the flu. But, of course, this would happen just literally a day or two before Halloween. So now we're trying to figure out how we can, make him feel well enough that he wants to do something. Of course, it'll be his decision to do something on Halloween if he wants to tomorrow. I feel like he will. And then also to how to get him to enjoy Halloween while he's sick. We'll probably end up going trick-or-treating for a little bit just so he can get that in. Probably cut it short because he probably won't be able to go for so long. Maybe drive around looking at Halloween houses because he was really into that. So that's my Halloween this year. Spooky, isn't it, folks? Renee says, I support you, Goldberg or Sandman. I would say probably I'm more of the ECW to Michael Brooks's what? WCW. Let's say that. And when I say Michael Brooks's WCW, I mean, you know, 2000s WCW. If you're a wrestling fan, you know what I'm saying. And I'm the pre-TNN era ECW. Right when he is hitting that subculture peak. Renee says there's Catholics getting on the evangelical, nationalist, anti-globalist, anti-Halloween. Speaking of Ezra, he says he freaked out due to Halloween and he had a breakdown. It happened to me when I was a kid. But he was excited about it. Not really a freak out. He was just excited about Halloween. But maybe that did do something. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe. All right, everybody. Enjoy your Halloween. I will talk to you very soon. Like I said, there's a show on Thursday. Be on the lookout for my piece coming out over the next few days on Mashable. Today's guest, Lynn, makes an appearance. It's about urban legends, specifically a new online urban legend called Momo. Should I bring up Momo now? No, you know what? Momo should really get his own show because I think he's interesting. We could talk more about that. Basically, but the gist of it, to not just leave you hanging here, is there's an urban legend that was spread on YouTube over the summer and then really started spreading throughout, you know, August, September, and October about this anonymous WhatsApp number. And when you contact it, you know, people sort of dare you, apparently, according to the legend on Facebook, to contact this number. And when you contact it, you notice you're contacting this really creepy image of this character called Momo. And Momo is sort of this half woman, half bird. She sort of really sort of resembles this, like, I don't know, Japanese horror figure, like the girl from The Ring or the mother, the wife from The Grudge. But she's got this weird, like, bird-like characteristics there, and she got this really, she got bulging eyes and this really big creepy smile, and this is spreading, this sort of Momo challenge where, according to the legend, you contact Momo and Momo contacts you back with these like harassing messages daring you and egging you on to take these various challenges, and then eventually as you progress through these challenges, the final challenge Momo sort of peer pressures you into doing is suicide. And there's been these stories spreading about children, kids, teenagers committing suicide all across the globe because of this Momo challenge. And, you know, it's I don't want to give too much away without A, you guys reading the article, or B, us having an episode about it on the show. Lynn really spoke to a lot of this stuff, but Momo is a little bit different and speaks to how things are spreading very specifically, not just since the internet, like Slenderman, but very specifically in the sort of influencer-driven YouTube algorithm type world we're specifically living in at this specific time and place and age. And, you know, it speaks to a lot of the politically charged things we talk about on this show, especially with how the right, white supremacists, MRAs, the Gamer Gators, the alt-right, the classical liberals, the anti-social justice warriors, any of these reactionaries sort of, you know, have this foothold over a lot of these streaming networks, but especially in comparison to social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, especially on YouTube over those networks and platforms. Renee asked, that's tomorrow. No, the Momo article will probably not be up tomorrow. Probably in the next day or two. I'll tweet it out when it's up on Mashable. And then this show will be back on Thursday for the episode about WWE going forward with their Crown Jewel event in Saudi Arabia, which is Friday, literally just, I think it's like just over 12 hours after I talked to David Bixenspan about it. So, Renee told me I should make a haunted house in Ezra's bedroom. Maybe I will. Maybe I will. I scare the kid enough as is, so maybe a haunted house would be too much. But anyway, happy Halloween, everybody. Trick or treat. Watch good scary movies. I'll recommend to you right now. You know, we were talking about The Blair Witch. That's always a good one. And a lot of people think it's corny. But it was one of my favorite horror movies when I first saw it. And for many years after. It really was the perfect movie for the time. For speaking of time and place, for like Momo and YouTube. A found footage film. Virally marketed in the late 90s, like the Blair Witch Project was, really the perfect sort of combination of setting and everything. Also, other good movies to watch, let's see. Night of the Living Dead, always one of my favorites, probably one of my favorite movies of all time. I could literally probably sit here for a whole episode and tell you about all these different zombie movies from George Romero's films, to you know, Lucio Fulci's zombie movies, great, and then even the really bad fake sequels, you know, not official, I should say, sequels to the zombie film. Here it was called Zombie 2 films. You know, those are all great in their own aspects. What else? The Witch is a great movie. You should watch that. I think it's on Netflix. Series-wise, I've been really enjoying the House on Haunted Hill series that Netflix just put up. Really, really good. Really, really good. Haven't finished it yet, but it's really good. What else? On Netflix, there's... Oh, The Invitation was another good one I recently saw. I'm having like a mental block. If you want to go to the movies, I just went and saw the new... Over the weekend, I just went and saw the new Halloween movie. That was a fun movie. Really fun. Really felt like the old Halloween film. You know, of course, you have to throw out all the ones that came after the first Halloween, because this is a sequel just to that. Sort of like how Disney threw out all the Star Wars canon that wasn't in the show and the official films. I should have written you guys a list. I'm sorry. But, you know, reach out to me on Twitter or whatever. I will recommend even more Halloween films. So go out trick-or-treating tomorrow if you are under the age of, 18? If not, if you're over that age, take your kids out and have a good time. Go to a haunted house, good time. Watch a scary movie, have a good time. If your kids bring home candy, beware of the various weaponry and drug paraphernalia stuck inside the candy corns and Snickers bars, just like I was talking about earlier with Lynn. I don't know what else to say, everybody. Happy Halloween. See you all next time. Renee says his ex-wife is from Romeroville. Renee's just throwing out throwing out Ghost Wars, apparently, is a show. Okay. All right, everybody. See you all next time on Doomed. Happy Halloween! Manhattan, sliding Vietnam, bullet in the head, Bobby O.D. on Drano on the night that he